Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, you're very welcome along to this week's episode of the Group Chat podcast from Virgin Media News. I am political correspondent Gavin Riley, joined in studio by news correspondent Richard Chambers. Richard, hello.
Hey, Gav.
And from Creechley and County Donegal by news correspondent Zara King. Zara, how are you?
Hi, guys. How are you?
I don't think at this point, Zara, we need to bring viewers up to speed as to why you are in Creechley or what you've been doing there. You have been on site pretty much since first thing Saturday morning. What have you found up there, and how have you found the people of the community and beyond as they're coming to terms with what happened last Friday?
Well, Gav, I think it's kind of, you know, pretty obvious to people who've been watching the news all week exactly how the people in Creechley are feeling. But it's changed a little bit perhaps over time, because when it first happened on Friday and the news sort of came through to the newsroom, there was almost kind of maybe a disbelief in the community as well. And I think even when we arrived here on the scene late Friday night into the early hours of Saturday morning, I think people were still sort of really in shock and quite numb about what had happened. The tone definitely changed. I was away for 24 hours on Sunday. I came back on Monday, and definitely you could see that the reality of it was really starting to sink in. You know, I think what's remarkable about this community in a lot of ways is that when this happened, immediately locals just ran to the scene. You know, I heard one person saying that it was our own that needed to be rescued, and we were determined to rescue them. And, you know, these are people who didn't have any, you know, first responder training necessarily. They just wanted to get in there and help. And we heard so many stories this week of people who with their own hands went in and pulled out the rubble to try and rescue their friends and their neighbours. And it has been a really, really devastating reality to learn of the death toll here, and to see the faces. Everyone who saw those faces in those photographs sort of recognises something in all of these people, because the thing about Creechley and the thing about Lafferty's as a local shop is that, of course, all of us can relate to that, can't we? That idea that we all stop in the local shop on the way home to get your bits and pieces, to get the messages. You know, some people were queuing up for the post office that day. It was a Friday afternoon. You know, people were bringing their kids in for a treat on a Friday. You know, just really simple things. And, you know, somebody described it this week as being sort of like a sliding doors moment, and we hear that term sliding doors, that a couple of seconds kind of could have made all the difference. And there were people who had been in the shop maybe 10 minutes beforehand. One lady actually who spoke to our colleagues on the Tonight Show this week is an ICU nurse, and she was on her way down to the shop and just missed it and arrived on the scene, and then of course was all hands on deck helping at the scene. But it has been the freak nature of this that has really, really upset people and caught them completely off guard. But you know, I have to say, like, the credit is due to this community in terms of the dignity that they have displayed this week, guys, in terms of, you know, the response. They straight away, you know, a lot of people probably would have seen a lot of the coverage of the coffee shop across the road. The team there really just, you know, kept the coffee shop open all night, feeding the first responders, and they were then taking in donations from all over Donegal. People were like just sending trays of sandwiches and coming together and really sort of doing whatever they could to kind of help. But it's difficult. There's really no words to explain this, such as the freak nature of it. And especially because investigators are examining this, there's no reason to suspect any foul play here. This is being treated as a tragic accident. So in many ways, people are left with more questions than answers. And it's been incredibly difficult. I know you guys have been watching on from this as well and seeing some of the response yourselves.
You've tapped into something there when you talked about some of the donations that have come in or outreach from there's been from other parts of the county, because for those of us that aren't from Donegal, it often strikes us as a very sparsely populated place. And although communities are very tightly knit together, that because it's such a disparate county and people are scattered all over it, that there maybe isn't as much of a sense of community across the county as has been shown. But it really has come through in the last couple of days, just to the degree to which they all feel loyalty to each other. And even when they've left the country and they're on the other side of the world, they still feel like they've got they're so knitted into the Donegal community.
Oh, no, completely, Gavin. Like, there's a huge sense of community here in Donegal. I mean, like, even going to some of the vigils during the week as well, people travel from all over north, south. Like, it's a huge county, but people are so incredibly close. And even, I suppose, Creta is kind of one of these places that you pass through when you're coming to the seaside here as well. And a lot of people would have stopped in Lafferty's. You know, people talk about it's kind of one of the stops on the road, it's one of the good shops on the road that you would pull over to maybe for an ice cream or whatever. And that people, you know, knew it. Everyone in the county knew it and could totally relate to it. The response has been enormous, I have to say, and people have driven from all over. Also remember as well that this was a local shop and there isn't another shop for miles. So there's been a real community response in terms of people offering to go and run errands into shops, you know, further afield for locals now who maybe don't drive or who can't get to a shop at the moment, because that's another part of it that we haven't really probably spoken about, because obviously the enormity of everything else, but just the logistics of kind of that amenity being gone now as well. It has a knock-on effect for the community, and it's been that's been a kind of a challenge as well, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah, I think everyone in the country is sort of trying to process this over the last, you know, week, effectively, since this has happened. It's very easy to sort of put yourself in a position where you can imagine it happening in your own community. That it is such the freak nature of it, as you're saying, Zara, is that this could happen anywhere. And we don't, obviously, these investigations still ongoing into exactly, you know, the cause of the explosion here. But in such a small community as Creta, you know, for such a huge thing to happen, it just really does beggar belief. It is just such a hard thing to wrap your head around. I suppose that's something which I suppose that takes time to actually work out, because you can imagine it happening, I don't know, in Meath or in, you know, in Waterford, or
imagine happening in my village
in Russian County Dublin. I can imagine it happening, and just even like which are bigger villages, and the enormous impact that can have. And particularly, I mean, people who are even watching the football last night will have seen, you know, Amber Barra talking about, oh, well, my grandparents are from there, and I know people who died there. I know people who are involved in the rescue efforts. It's impossible to talk about Creta, I think, without talking about how close-knit everyone actually is around it. Because that becomes almost a cliche when you're talking about these things, that this is a close-knit community. But you really can't find places which are more closely connected than parts of Donegal and Creta in particular. I'm sure that's something you've seen a lot over the last number of days, Zara.
Yeah, definitely. And there's people who you meet, Richard, who'll say to you like that, you know, like they knew all 10 of them, like they knew them personally, because that's how, as you say, how tightly knit the community is. And I think as well, you touched on that there, that idea of like, oh, people say, oh, it's a bit of a cliche. Like, it's just such a true statement, though, to say that people really come together in times like this. Like, and I can't overstress that. And when you witness that and you witness the kindness and the compassion, I mean, I'm thinking in particular of Siobhan, who runs the coffee pot here, and I'm sure she won't mind me saying, because I've interviewed her during the week, but just, I mean, Siobhan herself knew a lot of the people in the shop, like the customers who stopped in the shop were her customers too. Like, they're people, you know, it's all in the one area, you know, so she knew everybody in all of this. And Siobhan still sort of kept a brave face and kept going through the night, taking care of people and like went around, even journalists who arrived in the scene. She looked after journalists and was incredibly kind to all of us as well. And you know, in those moments, people really step up, and you really see you actually see the good in people a lot of the time in some very, very tragic circumstances. But look, there's no doubt for the emergency services as well, this is going to be a long road in terms of what they've witnessed. You can say to yourself, look, people are trained to deal with a crisis, but there's definitely a feeling here in Donegal that like what they faced into, training doesn't really kind of prepare you for it. And in a lot of cases as well, they were local first responders who again may have known people involved in this as well. So it was an enormous operation. What's been kind of difficult, I think, as well for people and even those watching the news and people listening to the podcast now is as we've gone through the week and the funerals are taking place, we're now learning a little bit more about the people involved in this. And, you know, sometimes when you go behind just a picture and you start to learn more about people, it becomes even more heartbreaking. You know, for example, Jessica Gallagher, who was 24, who had been out for dinner with her boyfriend on the Thursday night, and they were celebrating. She had gotten a new job. And that idea of just being young and you're starting out, your whole life is out in front of you. Like, it's just, it's really, really difficult to comprehend that this time last week, you know, she was out celebrating and now she's gone. And that's something that everyone in this community is grappling with. You know, likewise, Martin McGill, Martin's family had only lost his father earlier in the year. His father had died back in February, and his funeral mass had heard that he had missed his father terribly and it had been really difficult for him. But also that Martin was the kind of person who just like threw himself into the community. He was the type of person who ran errands for people. So he was in and out of Lafferty's kind of four or five times a day, not for himself, but because he'd be dropping messages down to people who couldn't drive up to the shop. So, you know, that just gives you kind of a sense of the type of people that lived in this community and that were part of this and that have been lost in all of this.
I think what was struck today, just in the coverage of the funeral of James O'Flaherty, one of those who died in the blast, his son, his 12-year-old son, Hamish, delivering one of the most remarkable sort of descriptions. And we all know people like this, and I think it's just important to sort of reflect on it. He says, "I'm grateful for all the people who've come here today. I would just like to say a few words about my dad. He was a great man. He worked very hard and very long each day, whether it was around the house or at work. He wore a jacket with a huge paint stain on the side of it everywhere. He managed this by leaning on a wall which was still wet with paint. He wore the jacket everywhere, to the shops, to the movies, to the beach. I'd like to say thank you to all the people who have given and offered so many things, the emergency services too, who were there within 15 minutes and also came to the wake. I just think it's just like, we all know characters in the community and just those little things about them that we remember about people.
Yeah.
I just think that that's something whenever I'm in Donegal, and I've been lucky to go to Donegal many, many times, it's just one of the most... It's such a great gift for, you know, noticing things about each other. I think that actually almost speaks to the closeness as well in many ways, that there's the fellow with the paint on the jacket. Are you sure everybody know him off that? And you know all, we know all James from that. I just think that there's something, you know, profoundly sad in those details.
Yeah.
Because it is, it's such a loss in however many different small ways that we lose people, that those sort of things do stick with us.
Yeah, there's something really universal about the idea of like someone who has a little, a small eccentricity, like they always wear the jacket with the paint stain, or even knowing like, you know, the 5-year-old little Shauna who was always asking for lollipops anytime that she was passing the local pharmacy. Like that, that's a universal thing that you can totally imagine. So not only is it the universal thing of the shop on the side of the road and that suddenly being an amenity that everyone uses and everyone can empathise with and identify with, but also the local traits as well. Zara, to peel back the wallpaper, sort of break the fourth wall just for a moment, it's a community which is not used to being at the centre of national and international attention. And I'd imagine that as the week goes on, it must be a very surreal experience for the local community and for the county to be magnified on such a scale, and getting messages from the Pope and from King Charles at a time when they're dealing with something so intensely personal.
It is. And like, again, I suppose I can't stress enough, like going back to, you know, a week, you know, this day last week, this hadn't happened. And this was just a totally, you know, no one expected to be in this situation. And I think as journalists and as media sort of working in the village and sort of staying outside the village, like we're just 10 minutes from the village where we're staying, you're mindful of that. You're mindful of the fact that we've been here now for several days and people are tired and they're grieving and you're trying to be respectful in terms of, I suppose, you know, we have to be here to cover this story. We have a job to do and there's a public interest and we want to cover the funerals and pay tribute to the people who have died. But also you're kind of conscious that like actually you're in the way now probably at this stage to some degree, and that you're trying to sort of be mindful of all of that. And look, they've been incredibly generous and as I say, dignified in their grief, and they've been very good to the media. And I think, you know, for the most part, I hope certainly from what I've seen, the media has likewise been respectful too. But like the truth of the matter is, you know, nobody's trained to deal with this situation, guys. You know, nobody in a village like this ever expects this to happen. Like there's no sort of like template of how, you know, when the Queen died, for example, you know, there was always that plan. People knew the Queen would die and there was a plan of how it would play out over a 2-week period. When a tragedy like this unfolds in a small rural community in Ireland, nobody knows really how to do it, and everyone's just kind of doing their best. And a lot of credit is due to the individuals who are doing their best, but it is understandable that as the week goes on, people are both tired and very upset. So I suppose as journalists, we have to be very conscious of that. We have to be very respectful of that. And, you know, you just don't want to be in the way. You know, there was kind of in the beginning, you know, even to look at the village kind of on the first day, there was nearly kind of more journalists around than locals at the time, because such was the interest in this story. You know, even the press conference that first day on the Saturday at the Garda station, sort of looking around, I didn't even recognise half of the journalists, such was that people had come from all over kind of. And, you know, generally working on the road, you kind of would know everyone to see. But if that will tell you that the interest that was here, that there was a huge international interest in this story, and it was because it was such a shocking and devastating incident to have unfolded.
It is obviously a devastating thing for that community to come to terms with, and in time, probably they'll be given the space and the time to do that. I think we'll draw a line under our discussion of that there. Suffice to say that obviously as the media moves on, it's not as if they are out of our minds or out of our thoughts, and we hope that everyone there ultimately receives whatever supports that they need to help themselves overcome this.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, you speak about how this has affected people across Ireland. Like, at the end of the day, we are a very small nation. things that happen in villages on one side of the island matter to us as much as the stuff that happens in the village next door to us. And you think about the extraordinary lives that these people had. These are all 10 individuals, but each of them had individual lives, and they were all very important to the people who knew them and to their communities as a whole. People will have been reading over the last number of days about Martin McGill, who was such a dedicated carer. And I think that even probably over the last couple of years, we realize how much people who we may not know on a personal level, how much of a difference and how much of an importance they have, that their dedication and their love and their commitment to their communities and to each other often has for the places that we live. So, yeah, I think the people of Chrysler will be in the minds and the hearts of all of us across the country for a long, long time to come.
Of course, the other major story of the week, far happier news, although Donegal had its own imprint on that as well, was the victory by the Republic of Ireland women's soccer team in Hampton Park on Tuesday night, which guaranteed their first ever appearance at a major tournament, and not just any old major tournament, but a Women's World Cup finals, to discuss which we are joined in the studio by Bernard O'Toole of Virgin Media Sport. Bernard, we told you this was a tie-free zone.
I thought I'd break out and go for the tie. I could lose it halfway through the chat.
Celebration, tie around the head is what we need to go to.
That's just to really get the tie around the head thing for later on. It's good to have it within arm reach. Thank you for coming on. Just to put the whole thing in context, well, like we said, Ireland have never qualified for a major tournament before. So to make any tournament would be a landmark, but to make a tournament like the World Cup, given the qualification progress they had, incredible.
It really is incredible. And the way it happened as well on Tuesday night was, of course, incredible. But yeah, but to put it in context, it was only 5 years ago that, of course, the Irish women's soccer team felt the need, the soccer team at the time, of which there are still some members in the panel at the moment, felt the need to come forward and say they weren't happy with the way they were treated. Flash forward 5 years and we're absolutely at the crest of this wave whereby we've qualified for a World Cup. And like you said, it's not just any tournament, but to qualify for a World Cup is, and the way they did it is it's a massive achievement.
When you say the way they did it, for people who aren't as familiar with the nuances or the strengths or which countries are good or bad, what was so remarkable about how it was pulled off?
I think you have to go back to a number of years ago. Vera Pauw and the FAI made a very brave decision that the friendlies they wanted to play at the time were against stronger nations. So the net result of that was we lost an awful lot of those matches. People were talking about a bad run under Vera Pauw. How's that going to go? She was resolute at the time in her belief that although they lost those matches, playing against stronger nations and losing would stand to a team far better than playing against weaker nations and have this run of fixtures, which we've seen before under Irish men's managers as well, where we win all these matches and friendlies and we get absolutely nowhere. So that happened a couple of years ago. We were very close in the last campaign to qualifying for the Euros. Heartbreak laid on that. But in this campaign, there was a steelness, there was a determination. And also, as we said, that an awful lot of members of these squad are playing at a very high level. You look at like Katie McCabe, major player for Arsenal. Denise O'Sullivan is really going to light up this World Cup. Excellent player. So there was a steelness in this campaign that wasn't there before. But then we had this convoluted playoff system that was difficult. We got through it and we had an absolute roller coaster of a night where Courtney Brosnan, the Irish goalkeeper, had a Paddy Bonner moment. Fantastic save. Yeah. We had chances which passes by. We thought, that's it. It's gone. And then Amber Barrett. And where do you start with that story after the week Donegal had produced an excellent finish, again with an excellent ball played forward by Denise O'Sullivan. So steelness of the campaign was there for all to see, and an absolute roller coaster.
Shout out, by the way, to our newsroom colleague Rob O'Hanrahan, because the little flow chart that he put together.
I knew we were going to talk about this.
Keep on top of that. Yeah. Don't sound so embittered, by the way. Like that was some piece of work, even just to try and put some sense.
It was particularly impressive.
Because it was a bizarre, convoluted thing. So the World Cup is now next summertime.
It's next summertime. It's slightly later than people may have imagined, because it's actually July into August. It's in Australia and New Zealand.
Okay.
So we're going to have the time difference there. We'll find out on Saturday week what group we're in. But even like I was out with Vera Pauw the day after the win, speaking to her before they all flew back. And she was saying, look, we'll put plans in place now, but we're going there to compete. And I think that's what Vera Pauw has brought in. She made superb reference to Sue Ronan and Colin Bell, the two managers that went before her. But she really has added that kind of steelness. And they will go to that World Cup and try to make a real impact in it. Because if you look at the performances we've had against stronger nations, Germany in recent years, we've played really well against the higher ranked teams. So they'll go there to try and really compete on the pitch, despite what they've done off the pitch and despite what they're going to do for the game in this country.
I think it's so incredible incredible, really, particularly for young girls and soccer clubs up and down the country to see this, to see these role models. That kind of can't see, can't be thing is really, they're breaking the glass ceiling on all of this. And I know, for people who don't know, Bernard's wife, Jer, is also a sports journalist. They have a little girl, Kitty O'Toole, who was up last night. She had to go to bed before the match started, Bernard, but I saw Jer said she was going to tell her the result in the morning. But like, for the likes of Kitty and the and kids coming up now through the system, this is a really big moment in terms of being able to see what the potential of what you can achieve. Is there way more support now than there's been before for women's sport and for particularly women's football?
Kitty was absolutely delighted. She didn't find out until this morning that Ireland won. She was in bed at 6:30 last night. I still think she's a little bit more happy with Ben and Holly than she is with the Republic of Ireland women's team right now. It's only 10 months. But there really is a bigger uptake. And I think if you see, again, and I think it's important to stress that this isn't an overnight thing. This isn't a fluke that happened nowhere. Going back to even what Zara was saying about the support, that the Talent Stadium has been sold out for many people they can get in, many bums they can get on seats, and very young fans that have gotten there in recent years. So it has been building. But I do think it's important, and this kind of feeds off what happened in England on the basis of the summer they had when they won the Euros. Mm. I do think we need to build off this and try and increase the game here. Of course, this is going to help, but hopefully, you know, there's going to be an awful lot of money coming in from this qualification that we can invest in the game here, because yes, 100% the interest is there, but we have to try to keep them and get more people playing the game.
I just think it's important that we sort of reflect, and how do we figure out how important a figure Vera Powell actually is in Irish football. Like, I mean, Zara, you're making the point there that this is inspiring to young girls around the country. There's no reason why this shouldn't be inspirational to boys as well. When we see excellence in Irish sport, that should be an inspiration to everybody. So I just want to know, what exactly, when Vera Powell came in, what did she inherit and how has she managed to do this? Because you mentioned the level that some of the Irish players are playing at, whether that's Katie McCabe, Denise O'Sullivan, Louise Quinn at the back as well. Yeah. These players are playing at awfully high levels. But how exactly does Vera Powell come in and change things to try and bring them up from, as you said, 5 years ago, when you're having these conversations about people changing in, you know, airports and all that sort of stuff?
I certainly think if you go back 5 years ago, Ireland weren't in a great place. What was happening off the pitch, it was building on the pitch, and I do think there were more and more going across. I suppose if you go back to the Ireland squad of 5 years ago, even a little bit longer than that, there's an awful lot of P-Mount Shelburne players, which is absolutely nothing wrong with that, but an awful lot of these players, on the basis of what happened under Sue Ronan and also under Colin Bell, there was certainly a shift there. And even go back to what we're saying, but more people going to matches in Talent Stadium, that was starting to happen. So Vera came in at a good time as regards, this is a squad that was quote-unquote going places. It was only a short-term contract she got at the start list, I forget. But then she moved in the right place. And just on Vera, Vera's had an awful lot of accomplishments as a coach. She got her native Dutch to their first Euros for 24 years. They got to the semi-finals of that. She got South Africa when she coached there to the Olympics. But she actually said this week to Virgin Media Sports that her biggest accomplishment, I know it's an emotional week, her biggest accomplishment of her coaching career is guiding the Republic of Ireland from where they were to this World Cup.
She's saying an awful lot.
100% of saying an awful lot.
Very esteemed coach.
But go back to the point of where we were at then. We were at a good place, not as good a place as we are now. And I certainly think an awful lot of that is to do with Vera. Yes, there are players that have got moves. And listen, let's not over-romanticise it either. But yeah, we've got the Katie McKays and Denise O'Sullivan's, an awful lot of other players are playing at a moderate good level. Yeah. There are more going across to play in the WSL and play maybe in Scotland and across Europe. But she has definitely maximised what she got out of this bunch. And the other thing as well, I think I don't want to get into too much of the technicality of it as well, but she's changed the system consistently. She has shifted players around. She has adjusted to the opposition. So, like I said, this isn't just a flash in the pan that she's come in, decent squad, let's get them going there. She really has molded them into a squad that's got to the World Cup and rightly got to the World Cup.
I think it's interesting to reflect, because I think there's an element of rising tides raising all boats. The change that's happened in women's professional football over the last number of years is something which we can all see around us, whether that's, you know, the US women's national team over the last number of Olympic Games and World Cups, people like Megan Rapinoe becoming household names around the world. You have Barcelona and Real Madrid setting record attendances for women's games, effectively selling out the Nou Camp. And then you have, you know, even across the water, the Lionesses winning the Euros last year.
Huge for them, because now routinely they will play their games in Wembley rather than playing them in provincial grounds, like a lot of the ones that were actually used for the Euros that took place there only this summer.
Yeah, nothing happens in isolation. Mm. That when you have excellence and you have money and investment and media coverage as well, which is worth reflecting on, that these things do have impact. And I think that, you know, you mentioned, you know, the players who are playing in great leagues now, those leagues have come on so much, and there's an interest in those leagues now happening. And it's amazing to see that sort of, you know, that infectious nature that people get behind things which they see, that's caught on here to such a degree that we are leading sports bulletins now, and rightly so. No one's asking a question about that.
100%
with women's football,
and the interest is there. I think the big conversation will be had when it eventually gets to a point where we're very close to it now. I imagine we'll see this over the next 12 months. This team want to play all their matches at Tallaght Stadium because it's their home ground, it's their fortress, it's a good size for it. Mm. But the more that the real compliment to this team will be when the Tallaght Stadium becomes too small for the interest that is there. I don't think we're too far away from seeing that.
Which would be remarkable in its own right, because sometimes for the bigger games, yes, they'll fill Fortress Tallaght, but there's been other games too, even in this qualification cycle, where they weren't always filling that. But maybe this might now be the big bang where people who may have been on the fence about it before will now say, well, I want to go and see them, and I want to bring the kids to go and see them. And maybe if the Aviva becomes the place where you do that, then it would be like, what a testament it would be for achievements if that's where it is.
Absolutely incredible. And it's certainly a group that are heading in the right direction. And what a story it's been for us.
Obviously, the story which everybody will have seen last night, Amber Barrett coming on off the bench as a substitute, taking that through pass from Denise O'Sullivan, controlling it expertly, dispatching it there with her opposite foot. And then the celebration, obviously a proud Donegal woman. She said in her interview, both of her grandparents are from Chrysler, and just about what it means for her and how difficult the time has been, knowing people who have died there, knowing people who are first on the scene. It is remarkable. I think everybody around the country, whether they were interested in football or not, could only be touched by it, could only take heart from these moments. And that is really, you know, we've been lucky in this country for a small footballing nation to have amazing stories along the way. But I just think that is something which I think will live on long into the memory and can be just transformational in its own right.
It just felt like one of those nights when you think back to so many examples when we qualified, obviously, under Jack for 88, 90. You think Alan McLaughlin's goal in Windsor Park, the late great Alan McLaughlin, to qualify in 94. It was one of those iconic moments just to have a goal scored away against Hamden Park. You have to remember, this team haven't produced huge moments on the road. So it was a huge moment on the road. But then when you add all that backstory to what's happened to Donegal, she's from Donegal, and then also to say that she had the wherewithal to think of all this at a moment when God knows what's going through her head. She's just made history. She's just scored a goal that's going to qualify us for a World Cup. And to have that moment to grab the armband and to bend to one knee was absolutely incredible.
Yeah, I think it was a testament to her, wasn't it? That, like, you know, with everything that's gone on at home for her, that she was able to focus and to get that done last night and to pay tribute to the people who had died here at the very end of that match, dedicating the goal. I thought that was really, really remarkable.
What's the mood like in the camp at the moment? When you come away, I mean, as a time recording, we're about, you know, I don't know, 15, 16 hours after it all happened, after the final whistle. Obviously, there's a lot of celebrations. Obviously, there's been a lot of, I suppose, discussion and discourse about one aspect of those celebrations. But being out there today and seeing, you know, the team out there and talking about what's actually been achieved, how is it for them 15, 16 hours on from all that?
The general response I got, I spoke today to Vera Powell, very cool, calm and collected and considered, obviously said her piece about the controversy, also said her piece on what she sees as her biggest achievement in coaching. Also spoke to Anya Gorman, who's a really interesting character, because of course Anya Gorman was part of that group in 2017. There wasn't too many there. Katie McCabe, Diane Caldwell, I think that's maybe at Niamh Fahy, possibly. And she spoke about, you know, 5 years ago, Liberty Hall, you know, listen, we can't get changed and hand back tracksuits getting changed in toilets at Dublin Airport.
Talking about going on strike.
And now five years on, she's there in front of me today. You know, and she actually made a great point where she said, at one stage last night, not that they ever felt the game was gone, but she potentially was playing her last ever game for Ireland. I think she's 33 years of age and probably coming towards the end of her career. Whereas, you know, you flash forward, you know, an hour and a half, and now all of a sudden she's preparing for a World Cup. Also spoke to Chloe Mustaki as well today, who has a really interesting backstory with health issues she had, and also two ACLs injuries as well, and she's battled back from that. So you look at the story in the squad. There's young players who can't believe that they're the senior players who are delighted to get this chance. Never thought they'd see this day. But as regards to the sink in, I don't think it's really sunk in yet. It has been an absolute whirlwind for them, obviously, you know, in terms of getting the result last night, but also all that's gone with that as well, as regards to the controversy today as well. But I didn't get a sense that it had all sunk in for them just yet. You couldn't wipe the smile off their faces, but it hadn't really properly sunk in.
Better content than Ben and Holly anyway.
You can 100%. Don't knock Ben and Holly.
Ben and Holly never made it to our house. We're still Pepe aficionados. Bernard O'Toole, thanks for talking through all of that. And sure, we will be following your coverage as they go on further again.
Pleasure. I'll keep the tie on.
Do.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's been a while since we discussed the full extent of the war in Ukraine. We discussed a little few weeks ago about the sham referendums that were taking place in certain parts where Russia was trying to annex them as part of its own territory. It's escalated in a fairly big way in the last 4 or 5 days. A lot of bridges involved.
Yeah, for a long time, people in Ukraine have, obviously they see Crimea as part of their own country, and it was up until 2014 when it was illegally annexed by Russia. And this land bridge that was effectively made by Vladimir Putin, his construction pet project, a road and rail bridge, has long been a target of hatred for Ukrainians who just, you know, detest the sort of the meddling, as they see it, of Russia in Crimea and the sort of the Russification of it. So it was attacked over the course of the weekend. It was, we don't know the exact details of that yet, which is quite remarkable,
really.
Nor do
we know the exact people responsible, because although there's been some triumphalism from people in the Ukrainian government and in governance, none of them have sort of been so explicit as to say, yeah, that was us.
Wouldn't be a great idea if you have done it to sort of spell out your methods, really, if you ever want to do anything else of the same way again. Like, I know there was that report, I think it was in the New York Times only a few days ago, that that bomb attack in Moscow a couple of months back, which targeted the daughter of a Russian nationalist.
Yes.
And that was the work of Ukrainian agents, according to US officials, but that was denied flatly at the time. So there will always be plausible deniability and things, and people won't want to go into how and why they did things. But that impact of that blast was monumental. And it has, in an already dangerous and inflamed situation, which has been ratcheting and ratcheting up as things time has gone on, there's been no fade off in terms of the intensity of this. The escalation came with obviously the annexation of those territories, those oblasts in the east of the country. This is a further escalation, which then provoked probably one of the most furious, I suppose, responses from from Russia, from Vladimir Putin since then, in terms of what he's actually inflicted on parts of Ukraine which hadn't been touched for a long, long time.
This is what's so stark about it, because we remember when the war broke out first and we were discussing, you know, what it was like to suddenly have war on the streets of a capital city and that there were blasts all over the country. And then over time, it seemed like Russia had slightly refocused or reoriented its campaign, and that it was only going to focus on those occupied areas in the southeast of the country, and that they'd kind of left Kyiv alone a little bit, and that there were other cities that were just getting by now and where life was almost unthinkably kind of returning to normal. And then suddenly, the Monday morning of this week, airstrikes and huge damage.
Airstrikes and cruise missile attacks. And
on Monday, I think, as well. Oh, sorry, I was just going to say, I just seen the pictures on Monday, was, you know, because there was people who were kind of going about their morning, going to work, going to school. You know, that there is, people are trying to get on with, those who stayed in Ukraine are trying to get on with their lives as much as possible. And to see those pictures of people on their morning commute, wounded, walking wounded, was incredibly shocking. I know we're seeing pictures coming from Ukraine for so long now, but I feel like it never gets to the point where it's not shocking. I don't think we've ever, and I hope we never do, reach a point where we're desensitized by these images. But to see people walking wounded on their morning commute was really shocking.
Which is what's so striking about it, Richard, is that it almost seemed, and this was the argument made by Volodymyr Zelensky subsequently, that it was an attack that was intended to cause as much human loss as possible because of the parts of cities that were being targeted and because of the time of day that it all kicked off.
Yeah, I mean, missile attacks, cruise missile attacks on, as Zara is saying, you know, busy junctions in Kyiv in rush hour in the morning. There's no accident really about some of that. There's no accident in terms of timing of missile attacks in Zaporizhia targeting apartment blocks in the middle of night when people are in their beds. The view of the West on this and the view of the Ukrainian government is that these are deliberately, effectively terrorist attacks. These are designed to strike fear into people at a time when people are vulnerable, either when they're in their beds and you know, you are completely vulnerable at that point, or when they're moving about the city and you can't ignore but the damage done, targeting things like, even, you know, there was missiles dropping near playgrounds and things like that. But also what was targeted in this is that there was a huge amount of damage done to infrastructure, particularly energy infrastructure. And if you think about the time of the year that this is being done at, obviously there's the whole energy crisis thing, which we're seeing all across the world now at this point. But also the fact is that winter is very much coming in Ukraine. And if you are knocking out and repeatedly trying to knock out heating, light and heat and electricity in major Ukrainian cities, there's an impact to that, a long-term impact to that, if you are trying to continuously wipe that out, particularly when you look at what's happening around Zaporizhzhia's nuclear power station, which is held by Russia and is apparently going to be disconnected completely from the grid from Ukraine and attached to Russian energy outlets. So, I mean, we are all talking about the impact of energy, the spillover of that into our worlds, into Ireland, into the United Kingdom, into America and wherever else around the world, with a very real impact and a very potentially horrifying impact to it, which we might be seeing over the next number of weeks and months in Ukraine itself.
And we've also spoken, Zara, repeatedly in the podcast over the last few months about the impact of all of this on Ireland and on the lives of Ukrainians who have now made their lives here, over 50,000 of them now in the state. And some of the difficulties that the state faces when it doesn't have the accommodation on an indefinite basis. And we saw that come to a head in the last couple of days with the proposal to relocate a vast community of Ukrainian people from Kerry, where they were comfortable and happy, to Mayo, a place they didn't know before.
Yeah, I think we need to be really frank about this conversation, because I think seeing the images today of people being relieved that they've now found out that there's been a U-turn from the government, they're not going to be moved from Kerry. How did it come to that? That is utterly appalling that it came to that. We have to be very honest about this. These people have fled a war zone. They have been through enormous trauma. They have come to Ireland seeking refuge. They have made themselves at home temporarily or to some degree, trying to put roots down in Kerry. They've made friends. Children have joined schools, classes. People have gotten jobs. How do we find ourselves in a situation where people are being told with very little notice, was it 48 hours, Gavin? 48 hours notice, they were going to be relocated to a completely different county. You're already miles from, you're already after going through so much. I just don't understand how this happens. And it was actually, even though it was good to see the U-turn and people were relieved, the fact that they were put through that over a 48 hour period, why couldn't this just have been sorted before they ever had to be notified in the first place? Why were they put through this entire situation? Why were mothers forced to tell their children that they had to say goodbye to the new friends that they had made in their new country? I just think in itself, actually, and it cannot be understated, it is actually appalling and embarrassing that as a country, we allowed it to get to a point that these people were going to be uprooted once again when they've already fled a war zone. I just think it was really unacceptable.
I think it's interesting.
I heard Patrick O'Gorman on radio the day, just the day that it happened, I heard him on radio saying he was asked about it and he said that he, you know, oh, look, this is the way it is and we have a lot of people coming in. And it was like, I felt it was like a thing of nothing, the response slightly. And I just thought, we have to do better by these people. We're opening our doors up. You know, we are limited on accommodation and we accept that as a country, but we have to do better. We cannot re-traumatise these people by you know, potentially uprooting them with very little notice and then at the final hour being like, actually, no, it's fine. I think it's just unacceptable.
Yeah, I think that's actually what sticks out to me in terms of the state's response to this, is that this was identified as an issue maybe about 2 days ago. It was flagged by people in Kerry that this is something which the families were very much objecting to, that this was something that they didn't want to happen. And as Zara saying that there was the interview with the minister and he was basically saying, well, that's how it is. And obviously we want everybody to be happy, but we just got to do this. And there's no stopping this now. This is a train which has left the station.
Yeah.
Why hold that position for 2 days and then flip it? I don't understand why you don't take a more open response to it and say, well, look, we'll look at the situation. Like, why is the communication and everything in this country? And I know that we've often said on this podcast that just blaming communication is the ultimate cop out.
But it's a huge part of it, though.
But it is a huge part of it, especially if you're trying to relay how these things work to a community and to the people affected, that you are saying, no, this is all happening, you're going. And then a couple of days later, surprise, you're staying put. But one other thing which I actually think it's important to reflect on at this point, because we often hear the difficulties of refugees and people settling into different communities, and you'll hear different voices chiming in and people online saying, oh, we don't want this here, we don't want that here. There's no space, there's no provision, there's no services. What was really interesting about this is that people in Killarney and people in Kerry were outraged by the virtue of the fact that people were being moved away from this.
Yes. Yeah,
that they were there, that they were conscious of the families who'd moved in, who'd fled from war, who were put living in their community, whose kids played with those kids from Ukraine, who had built up relationships and understandings with the people who came from Ukraine.
Jobs doing the local school. They're part of the community.
Absolutely. Yeah. That they were the people who had
locals in Kerry fought for them to stay. They were the ones who fought for them to stay. And that is community. Yeah. That is community. And they are absolutely... They did not want to see their new friends being moved away, and they completely recognised and understood the trauma that would impact on those women and those children. I just don't understand why policymakers and decision makers couldn't have foreseen that before it ever became, as you say, a communications issue, or before it had ever been announced in the first place. This should have been, like, these people should have been spared this trauma. It's outrageous that they weren't, and it's actually, frankly, unacceptable.
Yeah, I just think that's just an interesting point of it, that element that this was people on the ground who said, look, we're not happy with this. We're not accepting these people being uprooted from our community once more and moved away after they've gone through that whole process of settling again. So I think it's something to keep an eye out on. I know that in terms of the provision of accommodation for people fleeing from war zones and from persecution, both from Ukraine and from other countries around the world, there is a huge difficulty at the moment in accommodating people. But in terms of the actual response to it, when you have something that's probably working, what's the old saying about if it ain't broke, don't fix it? So I think that's probably something to keep an eye on.
And in a week, we'll be talking so much about the response of communities to things that have been traumatic. It's just another example of where locals are pulled together to try and look after their own. So something we'll definitely keep an eye out for. Richard, read any good books lately?
Plenty.
Yeah.
I was reading Maggie Haberman's Confidence Man about Donald Trump, which is very good.
Right.
Such a Fun Age by, can't remember her first name, Reed. Excellent book as well. There's a book, though, that is out, Gavin, which is attracting a lot of attention, and that the author is very much trying to bring that attention towards him.
The author is very keen to court a lot of attention.
It would not be like
this author. The author, of course, being Shane Ross, and the book in question being Marilyn McDonald, A Republican Riddle, which was supposed to have been the subject of an interview on Claire Byrne on her radio show on Radio 1 last week, which was removed for reasons which RTE have not elaborated on. Suffice to say that they reserve the right not to remove anything, and have since indicated through unofficial sources that the interview they thought was basically a bit boring and didn't
work. According to the Irish Times, RT sources said the interview was a bit boring.
It was a bit boring. But it has raised some questions, including allegations made in the Dáil Chamber that RTE had spiked the interview for fear of some sort of legal threat from Sinn Féin. And moreover, where the Taoiseach had alleged that Sinn Féin had been given a copy of the interview to cast verdict on it before it had ever made air. Which, if it were true, would be quite significant. Only thing being that there is basically nothing to suggest, Richard, that it is in any way true at all.
Makes it a fairly remarkable thing what actually happened in the Dáil when the Taoiseach said this. I think it was Paul Keogh, the Fine Gael TD, who was raising these questions about whether or not effectively Shane Ross had been censored by RTE by having his pre-recorded interview dropped, as does happen with radio programmes. Having worked in radio programmes for many years, stuff gets dropped all the time. But the implication really was that there was some political reasoning behind this. So he put this to the Taoiseach saying, does RTE have questions to answer here? And the Taoiseach in the Dáil said that it was his understanding, although he said may not have gotten everything right about this, but that there was a recording provided to Sinn Féin of this interview which never went to air, and that, you know, that there would be potentially a chilling effect on journalism of such a thing happening if it were the case that it did happen at all, as he did suggest that it did happen.
Yes. This thing that I've just suggested happened, which may have no evidence to support it, would be chilling were it true.
It's a fairly big statement to make. And it raises the question.
I was actually shocked when I heard him making the statement. Like, I text both of you and I was like, what? I'm obviously, you know, busy this week. I just was like, what is actually happening here? I was quite taken aback. Yeah. I thought it was a hot take.
It's a big eyebrow raiser for me now when I saw that the Taoiseach was intervening in this way. Because, I mean, whatever way you look at it, whether or not he's doing it for the right reasons or the wrong reasons, or if there was any validity, and again, as we say, there's probably no validity to it because it doesn't seem that there is from Sinn Féin or RTE's perspective. If there's any validity or whatever, it's still an intervention in the editorial independence of RTE.
Yeah.
Which not really a line you'd want to cross, particularly when you talk about the freedom of the press and you talk about what other regimes and other governments around the world, when they step into the editorial lines taken by broadcasters, state-owned or operated or independent. Big line to cross, and I do think it probably is one which I'm sure there will be a lot of discussion about for a little bit of time to
obviously
come.
Shane Ross has been on this station and plenty of others discussing the book and hasn't had any preconditions placed on the interview the same way that he alleges were the case in RTE. And obviously it is a matter of public record that Mary Lou McDonald is pursuing a case against RTE for comments that were made about her on Morning Ireland in the course of the last few months. So that's out there, and that may well have influenced RTE's decisions to render certain areas to be, you know, off the table or off limits. But Shane Ross, in his own piece in the Sunday Independent, where he outlined all of this, did say that, you know, with those areas removed, that the interview verged onto the bland and the beige a little bit. And in that light, it's really not unthinkable that something would just get left behind for other items on the day. And let's peel back the fourth wall here, Richard. You and I have both, at different points, been promoting books and have gone on the programme that's on that slot on Radio 1. And we know that there's this open thing, and Zara would attest to this too, because we see it all the time when you're looking for guests to come on TV, that RTE have this thing where RTE like to have the guest first. And if RTE find that a guest that they've booked or an item that they've booked has appeared somewhere else, they're always going to be less likely to want it. And it was the case in this instance that Shane Ross had his interview pre-recorded, but then before the slot went out, he was on other outlets, including this one.
Yeah, I think that's something which I think is needs to be reflected on in the talk about this, because I think people are, and their opinions on this are truly held, that they believe that there was some sort of, you know, backsliding on putting this interview out as some sort of token to Sinn Féin, or that this is just a whole, you know, mountain out of a molehill situation. But what does happen is that the media is a competitive place.
Yeah.
And if somebody is out there talking about an issue, whether it's promoting a book or a CD or what, a CD, what the decade am I coming from? Shane Ross probably still takes the CDs to be promoted. But like, if you're going on one outlet at a similar time slot to the one that you're trying to do somewhere else, like,
they don't like it.
You're going to be dropped.
Yeah.
And it does happen. Like, so that's happened. That happens to reporters and journalists and all that sort of stuff. But like, if you're out there and you're doing the rounds.
Something. If I had a euro for every time our editor dropped me in the first 3 years of working in TV3, I would have been a millionaire. I often had days where I had stories in the 12:30 that would just be slipping down the running order, down the line, under the line. Like, you'd be devastated. Your story got dropped. Stuff gets dropped all the time.
You'd know about it. You'd call it the drop zone. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
You'd say for the day I was hovering in the drop zone.
It is a thing, actually, that we if people
been in the drop zone,
if people were ever in our newsroom during bulletin times and they'd see us slaving over the running order, looking at it as if it were a Premier League table, looking to see who's going to get relegated down to the Championship or into further tiers. It is a thing that happens in our business all the time. Zara, we have about 30 seconds left. You wanted to pass a remark about a star of one of your favourite Disney films.
Oh, Angela Lansbury. We couldn't let it go without acknowledging, obviously, that she has died. And I suppose, look, my favourite, people will remember is Jessica Fletcher for the Jessica Fletcher stuff. I think for me, it was definitely Beauty and the Beast, one of my favourite movies of all time. What a comfort she was to all of us in our childhood. So yeah, sadly missed. Richard, I can't believe you just said if you're promoting a CD, I'm not letting you live that one down.
Join us again next week when Richard gets to promote his LPs, his 78s, and indeed all of his old papyrus scrolls that he's
coming soon on Betamax, the group chat. Yeah.
That is all the time we have for this week. Thank you very much, Zara King in Donegal.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard Chambers, here in studio.
Thanks, Gav.
Thank you to all of the gallery team involved in putting all of this together. And thank you for watching or listening. We will see you again next week on the group chat. Till then, cheerio.
Bye.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.